The VGRT Gaming Podcast, episode 715, recorded on February 28th, 2024.
The 715th edition of the TD Gaming Podcast and 548th episode of Video Game Roundtable. I am TJ Denzig.
I'm Scott Dirk.
And I am Jonah Falcon.
The VGRT Gaming Podcast focuses on game news from around the industry.
So, with the news we've been having recently, you can probably guess what the name of the podcast will be. Something like, "You're fired."
What a mess. What a bloodbath. Like, thousands of people just out of work. Since the beginning of the year. Like, it was bad enough in 2023, but, like, 2024 has had so many layoffs so fast.
And we're going to get into it, so we don't want to – don't get into it too deeply. Just
– yeah, yeah.
But, yeah. You know, there was a game from 2005 or 2006, which I might have done a gaming history on, but I forgot what it was. It's relevant, though. Unfortunate thing is I can't even remember what the hell the game was. There's a lot of good games in 2006, 2005.
Yeah.
It seems like such a long time ago, you know? I'm trying to remember what it was. What have you been playing there, TJ?
I've been playing the heck out of Penny's Big Breakaway. I loved Sonic Origins, or Sonic Mania, and the team that is behind it worked on Penny's Big Breakaway. This is their first original IP, and this is their first move into 3D platforming. It's cool. Like, this game, it kind of ticks all of the boxes that I wanted Balan Wonderworld to tick, but, like, successfully.
Yeah.
It's very charming. It's very colorful. The platforming itself is very good. Like, it's tight. There's a lot of challenges and optional challenges in the levels that make it fun to, like, try your best to get a perfect run on them. The music is fantastic. T. Lopez, who worked on things like he's worked on some of the Sonic games already. He also worked on the music for Streets of Rage 4. And the soundtrack here is just so charming and so pleasant to listen to as you're going through the levels. It really is just, like, a great, charming, kidsy 3D platformer in a time where we don't have a lot of developers that focus on that kind of game anymore.
Cool.
I guess the only one that would be is Nintendo, aside from Nintendo.
Mm-hmm. I welcome it. It's cool to see this kind of game. Like, this is the kind of game that would have fit right in the days of, like, Crash Bandicoot and Spyro the Dragon and all that, and Glover and all that stuff. It feels like it was ripped right out of that time, and it's super competent to boot.
So I've been trying to find the game that I was talking about, and I found something very interesting in 2006. You want to hear the best-selling games worldwide in 2006? Not in the United States, but worldwide. You ready for this? Like, seven of them are on the Nintendo DS, and it made me realize that the Nintendo DS just ruled that year when it first came out. Ranked number one was New Super Mario Bros., then Madden 07, then Pokemon Diamond Pearl, which wasn't even out in the U.S. yet. It was only in Japan. And then Pro Evolution Soccer 6, and then Brain Age, Final Fantasy 12, then Brain Age 2, then Animal Crossing Wild World, which is only on the DS, FIFA 07, Need for Speed Carbon, and The Sims 2 Pets. The Sims 2 Pets, yes, was the... But here's the other thing is that... Remember when a game like Brain Age could sell... one of the top sellers in the world. Remember Brain Age?
Yeah. It's a nice puzzle game.
Well, it wasn't quite a puzzle game. But here's the thing that really said something. Remember when there was the game that you had to speak out the name of the color of these shapes? You know, red, yellow, blue, that sort of thing?
Yeah. You
had to say brew, not blue, brew, because it was a Japanese game.
Mm.
They didn't have an American say blue into it. They had someone else say brew. And it always frustrated me. I didn't realize what I was doing wrong until someone told me, no, you have to say brew. In the U.S., it may sound more familiar because you have Madden 07 is number one, New Super Mario Brothers, Gears of War, Kingdom Hearts 2. And by the way, Kingdom Hearts, Gears of War, I think, was still number one in 2005. So that game really lasted. That was a system seller for the 360. Oh, no, it was Halo 2. And GTA San Andreas. Wow. And here's a... Oh, that's Top Game Rentals. But it's funny. In the U.S., the top games were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. 7 of the top 10 were PlayStation 2. And the next year, 7 of the top 10 were Nintendo DS. It's like the Nintendo DS told the PlayStation 2, get out of my way. It's my turn now. Did you buy a launch DS? I did.
Well, maybe. I got the one that I got the red one that came with Mario Kart 7.
Well, you know, if you got a launch DS, because my DS came with a port that allowed me to play GBA games.
Yeah, same.
Yep. And it was unfortunate because I also own a GBA, and that allowed me to play Game Boy Color games, Game Boy games, and I lost that ability. It's such a sad thing. Because there are some really good, you know, original Game Boy and Game Boy Color games that I enjoyed playing. Wow. Game Boy Advance version of Pokemon Emerald was number two seller. Anyways, we're getting way off track. Scott, what have you been playing?
I've been playing a game called Sovereign Syndicate. It's an isometric RPG set in London, and it's kind of a Shadowrun-style game. You know, where you interact with characters in the RPG setting, and you have, instead of dice, you have like these tarot cards you collect to help create your character. And there's, you know, like a lot of interesting puzzles, and it's a really, I just like the aesthetic a lot, and you have all these mysteries to solve.
You have to, it takes place in a steampunk world, you know, Victorian steampunk.
Victorian steampunk, yeah.
You know why it's called Sovereign Syndicate, right? Because it's a spiritual successor to Syndicate.
Oh, okay.
You know Syndicate?
Not sure.
Syndicate, way back in the day, I think it was even on the Amiga, is a game in which it was set in the future, and you had to run this group, a syndicate of assassins, and you had to, you know, it was like a turn-based game, you know, 3D isometric, but it was like a lot of things could happen. All the, you know, it was sort of like the Larian game of its day, except it was an isometric RPG. Like games of its ilk, like XCOM, the interface sucked. So they had a really odd, they did the XCOM thing in another way with the The remake of Syndicate was a first-person shooter. Just like XCOM did with one of its XCOM games. From the files of XCOM or something like that. But yeah, this came out like last month.
Give it a try.
It's an indie game. It's produced and developed by Crimson Herring Studios. But yeah. In a way, it reminds me of the Sunless games, the Sunless Sea and the Sunless Sky games. Do you ever play those?
I have not played that.
It's a game in which you're piloting around a boat or a train in space in the sequel, and just weird shit happens in it. Do you know the Sunless games, TJ?
Not too well.
Oh, okay. Give those a look. The Sunless Sea game. It's just really a weird game. Very, very Lovecraftian, but very weird, too. Anyways, I have not been playing anything. Nothing new, anyway. So that's my short little contribution there.
It's okay.
Anyways, we're going to move on to the quick news. And, a lot of this is just people firing things. So Electronic Arts is laying off 5% of its workforce. And they announced that the company is advancing the way we work and continuing to evolve our business. We have more on that, so we're not going to linger because there's additional news that just came out today on specifically what's getting cut, right? TJ probably knows more about this. Esports company ESL Faceit Group announced today that it's laying off roughly 15% of its global workforce. So this is supposed to be the number one esports league in the world, at least monetarily wise, if not in the headspace.
Yeah, ESL has been kind of one of the main organizations that has been running like Counter-Strike tournaments, Dota 2 tournaments. They do some Fortnite stuff. They do Call of Duty stuff. A lot of large games around the world have run tournaments and have organized esports events through the ESL. That's a big deal to see the company just drop 15% of its workforce in a, because these guys are like around the world. They are heavily sponsored by.
They're owned by the Saudis.
They had a huge investment from the Savvy Gaming Group, which is backed by the Saudi. It's the public investment fund, which is basically them pouring the royal family's money into games and entertainment and sort of diversifying away from oil. Either way, ESL is like probably one of the largest esports organizers in the world, and I would be a little concerned for esports if that company is facing layoffs.
Next, Sony is planning to lay off 900 employees. And an email shared by Jim Ryan, which was sent out to the companies, revealed that the PlayStation Studios in London will close in its entirety. FireSprite, the studio behind the VR game Horizon Call of the Mountain, will see reductions as well as reductions in various functions around costs. Sony Interactive Entertainment in the UK. So before we get into that, it's like there's been a lot. And recently, Activision Blizzard and Xbox, January 2024, 1,900 employees. Although that one may not be so much a recession as it is a function as part of a merger. So for those who don't know, whenever two big companies merge, there's going to be a lot of layoffs because then you can start getting a lot of redundancies, you know, workers doing the same job and they have to figure out who to let go. So that's often a part of a merger. In this case, though, there might have been part of the recession. Behavior Interactive and CI Games in January also lost 40% of their employees, which was 10% of their workforce. Lost Boys Interactive, a sizable portion. Riot Games, 530 employees. Twitch, over 500 employees. Airship Syndicate, 12 employees. Blackbird Interactive this month, an unspecified number. And Supermassive Games, which is actually another news that was like yesterday, and as if they were firing 100, there was 150 employees at risk. For those who don't know, Supermassive Games, they do all the, you know, like Man of Medan and Until Dawn, those cinematic choose-your-own-adventure games.
It's been really upsetting hearing how many people have been losing their jobs, and that's got to be hitting it hard.
It's global, so. I mean, yeah. There's a lot of other companies, I'm sure, they're paring off their workforce. It's sad, but it happens. I know it's not that sad until it happens to you, basically, but this is just a trend. I don't know, Supermassive Games, you know, it always felt like they were overreaching, don't you think? It seems like they thought they were something bigger than they really were.
I don't know, it's an unfortunate thing to see.
They're definitely one of the only studios that kind of does games the way they do them anymore. Like, we don't exactly have a lot of
FMV games.
Well, we don't have a lot of Telltale games coming out. What's his name? The Heavy Rain developers. They're not making a lot. They aren't pumping games out the way they used to.
Oh, thank God. And David Cage is a horrible writer.
Yeah, I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing. But, like, I am saying that, like, Supermassive Games has like a niche, and
yeah, they're essentially doing FMV games. You know, it's sort of like I watch these old MSD3K episodes and from the 90s. Do you remember the game Burn Cycle?
I remember, yes. There was Gabriel Knight on the Sierra. I think they made some of the best FMV games.
No, but this Bird Cycle was sort of like that other game starring what's her face from Dana Plato. Those games were basically just video files that were run off the CD. Burn Cycle and, oh God, I can't believe I forgot the name that Dana Plato was in. I'm pretty sure you remember it. The serial killer game. See, now you have to make me look it up again.
Yeah, I'm not certain on that one.
Oh no, you know it. Everybody knows this game. Night Trap. Remember Night Trap?
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Night Trap.
Yeah, it was one of the big games for the Sega CD game. But anyways, that's the kind of game that they're making, Supermassive Games. And yeah, you're right. I mean, adventure games have been on a downcline, but I will say this. There are a lot of FMV games that have been coming out in the wake of Her Story. All these full-motion picture adventure games, but they're cheap. You know, they're inexpensive. Supermassive Games makes big-budget games, and I don't think that is a good model for, you know, I don't think it's like making B-movies, but with millions of dollars, you know, with mega-budgets, sort of like when Roger Corman did Battle Beyond the Stars.
Anyway,
Let's talk about some positive news. Helldivers 2 player cap boosted again, this time to 800,000. This game has exploded, hasn't it, TJ? Because I know you're smack dab in the middle of that one.
Yes. So, like, it was a nice problem for them to have for a while there, right? Because, like, they just kept reaching capacity and just too many people wanting to play at any given time. I don't think they ever expected that much outpouring of love for and attention for the game, like, right out of the gate. Helldivers 1 was great. But I don't feel like it caught on the way that Helldivers 2 has right out of release. And for good reason. Like, Helldivers is funny and ridiculous and a pretty good shooter on top of that.
You know what? You know what's been trending on Twitter? Titanfall 3.
Yeah.
And the thing is that I think Helldivers 2 is taking the niche that Titanfall 3 would occupy had it existed, because there's a lot of people who want to see Titanfall 3 happen, and it's not.
Yeah, and even to the point where we're about to get mechs and Helldivers 2, so that'll be fun. It'll be interesting, because, like, you remember, Helldivers 1 was a top-down isometric shooter. So to be able to actually, like, and with Helldivers 2 being behind-the-shoulder third-person shooter style, it'll be fun to see what the mechs control and feel like when they come to the game.
I don't think it'll be quite the experience that Titanfall is, because Titanfall, the mechs are baked into the game, and it is so wonderful. Here's the thing. It's one of the few mech games in which you can feel powerful being outside your mech, because there's always a chance you can rodeo a mech and just hop on it and just pop in a bomb and blow it up. And they do have defenses against pilots who try to do that, but it's still so satisfying when you're able to take down a mech by yourself.
Mm-hmm. You don't really have that PvP element in Helldivers outside of, you know, team killing is possible because friendly fire is on. But what?
I will say, you know the thing about, I just realized, you know the thing about Titanfall that I just realized? I never felt like anybody was cheating. I never felt like there were campers. I never felt like there was any exploits in that game. I always felt like even if I was on foot, I had a good chance of taking down people. You know, it's one of those games in which it felt completely balanced.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it's also the way that the maps were built in the first place, to where, like, you had to kind of be mobile and,
yeah,
like,
the parkour was great in the game.
I don't think it from what I remember of playing Titanfall 2, it was very difficult to camp in that game.
And I'm gonna say the single player campaign in Titanfall 2 still holds up. It kicks us. As a matter of fact, I'm beginning to feel it's one of the best single campaign first person shooters ever in any FPS. The story is that good, especially the ending. I'm not going to give it away, even though it's, how old is it? Like 5-6 years, but it is really a touching last scene. You know, those last two words by your robot buddy. Trust me. And for those of you who are wondering what we're talking about, just buy the game. I mean, I know a lot of people who actually bought Titanfall 2, the Ultimate Edition, for $2 at one sale when it's normally $70. It's probably like $20 now. It's worth it. It's completely worth it. Even if – here's the thing. I don't know if the servers are probably still going on, and I think there's still people playing it, but the single-player campaign just knocks it out of the park.
Yeah, I agree. That, like, Titanfall 2 is probably one of the best single-player campaigns that's ever been put in a first-person shooter, if you ask me. Just a really good...
No, I'm about to say, and this is why you're supposed to be careful about what games you're competing against, and don't put smack dab in the middle of two big, big releases.
Agreed. That was the stupidest thing that they could have done. And then a part of that goes to, like, Respawn has been owned by EA for a pretty long time. I think did EA own Respawn?
No. EA did own them, but Respawn insisted on that release.
That's so dumb. I don't want to be mean, but like,
they thought it could compete. They thought it could compete.
Oh, the hubris.
Trying to remember which two games it was.
It was Battlefield 1 and Call of Duty, I think, Infinite Warfare.
One of the Call of Duties, yeah. And they just put it smack dab in the middle of them. It's just... And keep in mind, one of those is owned by EA!
Yeah.
They're competing against their own... That's, by the way, that's evidence number one that EA did not do that release date. Because EA would not have released two of those games at the same time. No, Vince Zampella wanted it between those two.
That's a real shame.
It was a big, big hit on the Xbox One, and they figured, you know what? We have enough cash. It's multi-platform now. No. What's really interesting is that they actually made a major patch last year in September, which made people think maybe they were going to make a Titanfall 3. But unfortunately, Apex Legends is just in their way.
Yeah, and outside of, like, working on a Star Wars game here and there, I don't think that Respawn is going to get away from Apex Legends ever.
Speaking of which, first game news. Go ahead, TJ.
Respawn Star Wars FPS is canceled, but work on the next Jedi game, Black Panther and Iron Man, will continue, from IGN. Today, EA announced a major company shakeup that will result in roughly 670 individuals, or 5% of its workforce, losing their jobs. As a part of that same reorganization, Respawn's Star Wars FPS in development at Respawn is being canceled. Not much was known about the Star Wars FPS, but it was rumored to feature a Mandalorian protagonist in some way. The fate of EA's Star Wars strategy game is also unclear. EA is undertaking the move in part due to what it perceives to be a rapid shift towards the large open world games, massive communities, and live service games.
Hold on. Now, EA is not reading the room there, are they?
No.
I think a lot of these companies are not reading the room.
Yeah. There are only a few live service. Oh, by the way, I told you this before in Skype. Now I know why Grounded went multi-platform like it did. Because of Small End. Small End is a multi-platform game that is basically a fantasy version of Grounded. And Microsoft said, we don't want them eating our lunch on other platforms. They said, you know, we're just going to release Grounded everywhere. It has to be. And here's the thing. Small End was actually started development before Grounded, so it's not like they're copying. It's just that Microsoft is aware that if we don't put Grounded out there, we're going to lose money, you know? So they say, you know what? Switch, PlayStation, guess what? Here's Grounded. Ignore that other game. Although I will say this, Small End is really, really, really good. From what I understand, it's a really good game. It's not quite Grounded. It has the same small people, open world sort of thing, but it has a slightly different take on it. For one thing, you know, you're elves, so you have more mastery over the insects. So it's not like every insect may be a threat. It's more like you're riding around on your, you know, you're just a small person in a big world, but it has a different feel, obviously, than Grounded. Have you seen anything from Small End?
I have not.
Okay. Check the video out at some point and just laugh and think, oh, God, if they didn't start developing this before Grounded, you would have said, oh, this is a complete ripoff. Anyways, getting back to Respawn.
IGN understands that the team previously working on the game, on the Star Wars game, will largely be reassigned to other projects, including Apex Legends, Iron Man, Black Panther, and Jedi, for which EA has confirmed a third installment. The Star Wars Jedi franchise will continue despite EA's move to focusing on owned IP, and EA is said to remain focused on its long-standing relationship with Marvel and Disney. Additionally, EA will be restructuring its Battlefield team somewhat following the departure of Marcus Lehto, announced yesterday. It's sunsetting Ridgeline Games, folding some of its developers into Ripple Effect. Danny Isaac and Darren White at Criterion will oversee single-player work on the series going forward. EA is focusing on in-house franchises such as Apex Legends in a pivot away from future licensed IP.
I have to say, at least I like the fact that EA is still doing, you know, single player games. I mean, that's one of the big things about the Jedi series right now is that it's not a live service game. It's just a straight out Tenchu meets Star Wars game. And I noticed I didn't say Dark Souls because it has more in common with Tenchu than Dark Souls.
Yeah. Just everything about this, though, like this. Did they learn nothing from the first Star Wars Jedi Fallen Order succeeding? Like, the whole thing of the EA was about beforehand was like, single player games can't work. We can't make single player games. And then they did Star Wars Jedi and it sold like hotcakes. And they were like, okay, maybe we can do like one or two single player games. And it feels like years later, we're right back on the same EA pattern with this stupid rapid shift towards open world games, massive communities, and live service. How many live service games have failed in the last year?
Here's a question. How many live service games can one person play? See, that's the big thing. And you have to understand, you know what else is live service? MMO. So someone who plays World of Warcraft ain't going to play any of the live service games, you know? They just can't. They don't have the time for it. They have their guilds, they have their clans and other games. They're not going to start a new one.
I'm beginning to think that large-scale AAA video game development might be unsustainable simply because leadership is fucking stupid. Like,
here's the thing. Microsoft is doing a smart thing with its live service games. Minecraft, Grounded, Fallout 76. You know, these games have wildly different fans, you know. I don't know if there's a lot of crossover I can see a crossover between Minecraft and Grounded. But also, those games aren't very, you know, they're very soft touch. You know, Scott, when you play Minecraft, how often are you going to, do you feel, have the, oh, you have to do the Game Pass because of FOMO and all that stuff? No, you occasionally get a few skins every so often and that's it, right?
I haven't bought anything for Minecraft since I got Minecraft because I play Java, so I don't have to worry about the game store. I just get whatever skin I want, and you know.
But even if you're playing everything, right? But here's the thing: even if you played on the thing, you're never really pressured into buying anything. You know, Grounded, you're never pressured into buying anything. Fallout 76, even that, you're not really pressured into buying anything anymore because they keep on. They're moving away. They've moved so far away from the original concept of Fallout 76. Oh, it's going to be an empty world, and, you know, it's all blah, 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 blah. Okay, yeah, now we have NPCs. Now you have this. It's basically an MMO without being an MMO, you know. But also, it doesn't really hard sell you on anything. I mean, the only thing it hard sells you on is DLC. And by DLC, I mean large-scale DLC, like this area and this area and this area. You know, but you really can't do the... What's Marvel's Avengers sort of hard sell on DLC? Like, if you don't buy something, it acts like you hurt its feelings. DJ? Somebody? I guess I shocked you.
Sorry, I was...
I haven't played the game, so I can't really comment on that.
Yeah, Marvel's Avengers, by the way, I bought. Because if you remember, they had this thing in which if you bought the game, you buy it for like $1, and then you could get all the DLC for free, and then they were going to take it off the market. So you had to buy it right there and right then, you know? So now I have Marvel's Avengers, and it's no longer really a live service game because, you know, everything is free in it. Anyways, we're going to move on to Pokemon Presents 2024. Not a lot really came out of that we weren't expecting. There's just a lot of, you know, a TV show, an anime. Okay, great, whatever. The only thing that we really can discuss is Pokemon Legends Z to A. There's a teaser for it, and it's being released simultaneously in 2025. And it's going to the shiny Lumiose city from Pokemon X and Y. And there's speculation it's going to be a Switch 2 launch title.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard a lot of speculation on some games being delayed until the Switch 2 comes out.
This is a good thing. It's good to see Pokemon take some time off. It needs it. Because Pokemon Scarlet and Violet, I liked its open world elements. I saw potential in it. I liked its creatures. I think some of the monsters they introduced in that game were really great. But the technical flaws in that game were kind of unforgivable for a franchise that large and that popular. And Pokemon, like, to the point that, like, Pokemon Legends that came before it, Pokemon Legends Arceus, that was a better game than Scarlet and Violet, in my opinion. So to see them take a year off, like, give it time, let it rest, really make, hopefully, take that extra time to pour the effort into the game and polish it up and make sure that Scarlet and Violet doesn't happen again. That's really important. And I feel like I am looking more forward to Pokemon Legends EA than I have been to a Pokemon game in a while, specifically because it looks like they'll, first off, I loved Arceus so much. And second off, like, it sounds like they're going to take the time to pour quality into it.
Yeah. And they're also going to, in the meantime, just, give more content to Scarlet and Violet. They also announced Mighty Venusaur, Mighty Blastoise, and Mighty Charizard battles for Terror Raids. So basically, they're just going to keep people preoccupied with Scarlet and Violet while they make this Z to A.
Yeah, and we also learned, like, there's also going to be, like, a new Pokemon trading card game coming
out. Yeah, a new app version of the TCG, yeah.
They're which they've had TCG on mobile for a while with Pokemon TCG Live, but this looks like it's going to be like a completely revitalized version of that. It's going to have like this setup where you can open two card packs a day and like dig out the cards. You can trade them with other people. You can have local battles.
They're going to have quote unquote immersive cards in which you touch them, the characters will move around.
Yeah, they showed off some of the cards, and first off, like, it looks like they got it looks like they're going for that full-on feel of when you rip open a booster pack and you get that fresh pack of cards right out and start flipping through them. It needs a little attachment for your phone where it sits on top, and when you open the card pack, it, like, spritzes your face with that new card scent. But, the free two packs a day absolutely means that there's going to be buyable packs as well. So this game is probably going to be printing money when it comes out.
By the way, one of the things that can't underestimate is that it's going to also have the new streamline rules. So you can do quick battles with it.
Yep. They mentioned right away that it's like collecting, trading, being able to trade with people that you're friends with. And then also local battles with people that you run into. And I think online battles as well. I feel like a game like that has to have online battles, right? Because that would be ridiculous if you just had only local battles and something like that.
Yeah. I don't know if this is evidence of noticing or caring about what's going on with Power World. I think, I don't know. I mean, this isn't, having it come out in 2025, I don't know if that's like, maybe that's sort of like, we'll see if this Power World thing is still around in 2025, because you never know. I mean, everybody loves Helldivers 2 now, but like a couple of months from now, gamers can be fickle. They can just move away from it. So people may just move away from Power World. So we'll see. But I do think that maybe they're understanding that we better up our game a little bit.
Yeah. And I mean, like, good for them. Like, I'm glad that Power World pushed them into a corner where they had to reconsider the situation because, like I said, Scarlet and Violet cannot happen again. That would,
well, sure.
Like, it can.
It can.
But it absolutely shouldn't. Because it's Pokemon. It's one of the most money-printingest franchises in the world. You can't just throw... I mean, you can throw shoddy shit out there, but you shouldn't. A lot of people really like those games, and they don't like spending $60 for fucking crap.
Well, that's why there's plushies in the anime. So.
I know, but, like, I just want... Like, I and millions of people around the world just want to play a good Pokemon game that doesn't, like, break and run at 20 frames per second as you're trying to just walk across the world and see what's going on.
You know, here's the thing, and I've talked about this before. Back when Enix was just Enix, you know, they weren't owned by Square. They had a game called Dragon Warrior Monsters, which is basically Pokemon except done right. And I just would like to see that IP come back. I don't know why they haven't brought it back, or maybe it's only in Japan. I don't know. Have you guys ever seen it?
Which one? I think I have. That does
Dragon Warrior Monsters. Like, I mean,
I think I have seen that.
Yeah. I mean, there are spin-off games, but I don't care about spin-off games. They actually released the Dragon Quest Monsters The Dark Prince last year, right? For the Switch. But it's not the same thing. It's not a Pokemon-style game. It's just an RPG. The only two that really were the Dragon Warrior Monster games, last one was back in 2001. Long time, God, and now I feel really old. I mean, they spun off into the Terry's Wonderland games.
Yeah, like...
And that game still influences... I mean, a lot of the characters that you got in Dragon Warrior Monsters, you see in the Dragon... Well, they call it Dragon Warrior in Japan, but it's Dragon Quest here. You see it in they see them in Dragon Quest. It's sort of like taunting you. You know, so, hey, remember these characters from Dragon Quest Monsters? Well, look, here they are in Dragon Quest. Too bad you can't play Dragon Quest Monsters.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's like they are making a lot of games as they go. It's a shame, you're right, that they're not like putting more into that idea because they could be seriously competing with Pokemon on every front. But I'm not sad to see the variety that comes out of having Dragon Quest do all sorts of different spin-offs in addition to the main game. Like, it's cool that we got Monsters last year, like a version of Monsters last year.
And here's the thing. You know how stupid it's become? It's like, in America, they stopped having breeding. They now had synthesizing, in which instead of having a male and a female character breed, it's a plus monster and a minus monster in America.
Hmm.
It's still gender, you know, still breeding of genders in Japan, but here, no, we can't have sex. We can't have sex in our games. No, we have synthesizing. What the ever-living fuck? It's just bad. Like I said, I wish Square would actually use the IP that it actually owns and do something with it, rather than just sit on it. And if they do anything with it, it's usually in Japan and just a spinoff. Anyways, let's go on to the next item. Go ahead, Scott.
Alrighty, which item are we on now?
Final Fantasy.
Okay. Final Fantasy VII Remake's final scene gets a script change 2 days before its sequel drops. This is from PC Gamer. In the run-up to the next episode of Final Fantasy VII Remake, the first chapter received a new patch. While the official singular note is just fixes to several bugs, Square Enix has actually snuck in a change to the English localization that has fans up in arms. The original line is spoken by everyone's favorite flower girl, Aerith. Just as the gang makes their way out of Midgar, the original line, "I miss it, steel sky," has been replaced with the markedly less poetic, "The sky, I don't like it." This has gone down about as well as you would expect. As understood, this patch is mainly intended to tie up some continuity threads between the remake and its sequel, Rebirth. For example, an adolescent Tifa now has a shirt underneath her outfit in the cutscene, primarily to match Rebirth's design. As for Aerith's unpopular line, the best argument in favor of the change was a link to Crisis Core, Final Fantasy VII Reunion. In it, Aerith is characterized as, rather than being fond of Midgar's steel plates overhead, the plates that hang overhead the slums, she's afraid of the open one. This was actually touched on in an interview with the remake's director, Tetsuya Nomura, as translated by CEO of Aitea Japan, blogger and Final Fantasy superfan Audrey Lamsam. As per translation, the literal Japanese line, something along the line of "the sky, how I hate it." When asked about the line, Nomura states, "For Aerith, the sky symbolizes sadness. The people who were dear to her, such as Zack and her mother, Alfana, had all returned to the sky, and the sky that she sees above her in the slums was covered by Shinra too. The calamity destroyed the ancients. Genova also fell from the sky. All these incidents remind Aerith of the sky, which is why she hates it."
Dumb line.
This is news to me because I don't remember her being particularly fond of Midgar when in the original game.
She talks about the sky, the steel sky of Midgar. This sky, I don't like it. That is, someone did not get.
But that wasn't the changes I've heard people complain about in my corner, I guess, of the fandom.
Oh, what changes are in your corner are they complaining about?
Freaking Tifa's bikini, I guess, is what they were complaining about, and the piano that apparently doesn't have a sheet music, and you get booed if you play bad because you don't know what keys you're hitting. So I don't know. That's what I've seen people complain about.
I would just be pissed because the game was released. Let it go. You don't need to change anything. Don't do the George Lucas thing in which you're going to just change everything after you released it.
Yeah, that's my opinion, too. I felt like we've been flooded with so much Final Fantasy VII world-specific stuff that it's like, enough is enough. Let's just move on to new worlds then, you know? Because I'm tired of this whole, we need a sequel, you know, milk to death this one world and story until it's no longer profitable.
You know what? I don't think fans give that much of a shit about continuity. Seriously, this is not Mass Effect we're talking about. If they wanted continuity, they would have made one game instead of a bunch of chapters like some Twilight movie or a Hunger Games movie in which they split apart the game. I don't know. TJ, what do you think?
I think that that active patching is maybe one of the best and worst things to ever happen to video games.
I mean, I don't mind quick fixes, you know, but that's for bugs, not for content.
I said one of the best and one of the worst.
I know, I'm just saying, I like quick fixes, but it should just be for, you know, fixing bugs, not to keep fooling around with a story that you already wrote.
Once upon a time, you got a game, it never got updated again, and you just dealt with whatever was going on in it.
I remember that era.
As a PC gamer, here's the thing. Once upon a time, if a game was, you know, had a bug or two, guess what the developer had to do? They had to ship out the 5 1/4-inch floppies to people, and that cost money. There was no internet in which you could just download it for free. No. You had to pay money in order to do it. So when they made sure, A, the game was bug-free as much as they could, and B, if there were bugs, they had to work on it hard because they knew that they're going to have to spend money to send these discs out to people to fix the game.
So what you're telling me is it made everybody up their game and actually try that much harder to ship a finished product from day one.
The threat of losing money is always a good...
Even when you think you got them all, there's still some bugs left, you know, and it could be really frustrating, I think.
And sometimes, I'm going to go out there on a limb and say, sometimes those bugs are charming. Sometimes those add to the story of the game. Sometimes that adds to the conversations that people have about it years later.
Well, here's the thing. Sometimes
Marvel vs. Capcom has a soft lock where one of the characters can just freeze the entire arcade, forcing you to have to go around and reboot the whole thing to start the game again. And sometimes that's just funny, and we learn about that all at once, and it's crazy, and we talk about it for years after it happened.
Here's the thing.
Another good example is Suikoden 2's Matilda glitch, where you push open the door and you can reach a whole section of the game a lot earlier, like 10 or 20 hours earlier, and you level up really crazy. And now I hear that the remasters aren't going to have that glitch because the PSP version has that bug fixed, and you know the remasters won't have it. And so a lot of people are like, oh, we want the Matilda glitch. So, yeah, that's a good point there, TJ.
Here's the thing. Back in the mid-90s, there was a game called Front Page Sports Football Pro, and there was something wrong with the field goal kicking. So you know what I did? I actually called Dynamics, spoke to the developers, and chatted with them about their game, voice-to-voice. It was on the phone, and they sent me a patch disc because they had fixed the bug over there. But can you imagine just calling up the developer and saying, hey, I'm having a problem with this. Is there any fixes for it? Sure, we made this. Can you imagine doing that today? Can you imagine me calling up Warren Spector and saying, hey, something's wrong with my copy of Deus Ex. Can you help me out with it?
With some developers, you can, like the indie ones, you can do that. You can get on Discord or email. Oh, no,
but here's the thing. This was a large company. This was Dynamics was a developer, and they were doing – I think it was under Sega. Sierra. This is Sierra.
Yeah, I did that too. I had an Incredible Machine bug, and I wrote to them and told them about it, and they said, we'll send you a disc, and they sent it to me, and I installed it.
But you have a conversation with them, right? You could actually have
At least on the email, yeah.
This was on the phone. Okay. Also, the thing is that I was actually a beta tester for the Incredible Machine 2, and you know how I got that way? I asked them, hey, can I help play test any of your games? Sure. And they sent me the disc. And I helped them. I helped work on it with them. So, yeah, back then it was a smaller thing. I mean, now you can talk to them on Twitter and all that stuff. But to be able to call them and have these conversations is something I miss.
Yeah. That is a nice thing to be able to do, to talk to a developer directly.
And now you have a guy who's running Madden who blocks people on Twitter when they talk about the bugs that are in Madden.
I didn't know that. Oh, that's funny.
Next item. Star Citizen developer hit with layoffs amid claims of a highly toxic company. This is from Eurogamer. This is a different kind of layoffs, folks. And this is depressing, actually. Star Citizen developer Cloud Imperium Games has suffered layoffs amid unrest due to relocation and accusations of a quote-unquote highly toxic company. Game director Todd Pappy left the studio last month, according to LinkedIn. Massively OP has since reported a number of other high-profile losses at the company, leading to lead producer Jake Ross, level designer Dane Kabuka, Austin Q&A lead Vincent Sinatra, and Austin senior Q&A analyst Andrew Rexroth. You know, all these Q&A people leaving, it's like, who's testing your games? Furthermore, former producer Annie Bouffard shared on LinkedIn that she had resigned from a quote-unquote highly toxic company and claimed she was gaslighted when she expressed concern about potential layoffs. She said mass layoffs had been disguised as a quote-unquote relocation of staff when few were able or willing to move. Bouffard was a producer at Montreal-based studio Turbulent, which was acquired by CIG last year. Back in 2021, CIG announced the opening of a new UK studio in Manchester, with the aim of becoming the company's UK headquarters, along with its offices in Los Angeles, Austin, Frankfurt, and Montreal. The likes of Rexroth, Kubica, and Sinatra have all shared on LinkedIn they've been laid off. And Stanley Kubica specifying this is due to quote-unquote restructuring. It's unclear if the move to Manchester was a defining factor in these layoffs or if this is just speculation from Bouffard. Well, there's a lot of people in the United States who don't want to move to England, so I'm pretty sure that's a part of it.
Yeah, that is really unfortunate. I know companies have done that kind of thing before, but like CIG, have they released and finished Star Citizen?
Star Citizen is being played by a lot of people. It's sort of like Minecraft, in which it's in perpetual beta and they keep on iterating. And from what I understand, it's really, really good. It's just that they're not quite ready to, you know, it's a game that a lot of the people who are actually playing it are having a lot of fun in, right? But it's not finished. And it's sort of, you know, there's something about it. You know, you go to a planet, you lift off, go through its atmosphere, travel to a fully realized city in some planet, sort of like Star, it's like Starfield, except more, you know, except it's more simulation based. But yeah, whenever you hear people leaving a company and the words toxic are coming out of their mouths, 95% of the time it's true. You know, it's not a disgruntled employee. No, it's actually a toxic company, especially in the video game industry.
Yeah, and I know that Star Citizen actually has like a game out there somewhere, and I know that the people that have bought into it get to play it, but it's always just like seemed a little bit like a scheme more than a game.
Well, only because they raised so much money. But here's the thing: the money that they've raised for it is basically on par of something like with Call of Duty, so it's not insane, right? It's just because they crowdfunded it that it seems sketchy, but it's no different than any quadruple A game that you see out there.
It's not so much that they crowdfunded it, it's that they've crowdfunded it for so incredibly long and keep crowdfunding it with more and more ridiculous options.
I think it has extremely high budget Minecraft.
Right?
And you're gonna make quadruple A a thing?
Well, here's the thing. No, quadruple A has been around for a while, that term. That's the thing to describe games like Call of Duty, which EA, or is it EA or Activision who does Call of Duty? It was Activision, right? Yeah, Activision. Activision just has everybody from every studio contributing to Call of Duty. And I know that bugs a lot of people, like TJ, because you have all these developers being pulled from the projects they want to make to making Call of Duty, like Vicarious Visions. What the fuck does Vicarious Visions have to do with Call of Duty? Nothing, but you know what? Let's have them work on the physics engine or something. I don't know. Just something that they didn't really sign on to do, right? So that's a quadruple A in which they just take everybody and they just pump hundreds of millions of dollars. Then they pump hundreds of millions of dollars in advertising. And the game makes a billion after the first week because people just have to buy it anyway because there's nothing else for them to do. So there is such a thing as a quadruple A game.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah, you hit the nail right on the head. It bugs me. It bugs the hell out of me that people have to these large companies basically consolidate a whole bunch of people working on cool things into one or two different mega franchises, and it just kind of sucks. But as far as Star Citizen goes, like it's just. I mean, good for them for finding their audience, because there is clearly for them to have the gall to put together a $40,000 package that gives you a ship. And
this is a pre-release thing, remember?
Right. That they have to be like, they have to know that somebody out there has asked for that, right? Like somebody out there is actually going to buy that for
the DJ. Let me introduce you to a little game called EVE Online now. In which real money has been lost. Say what you want about Star Citizen, no one's actually lost real life money from it.
Right. You're right. Like, people have lost thousands of dollars in EVE Online just over the fact that like it costs a lot of money and a lot of time and a lot of premium resources that can only be bought with money to get some of the best and biggest chips in that game.
So here's the thing, though. At least there is Squadron 42. Which mm-hmm. is the single player version of Star Citizen. So I'm hoping, I can see it happening if things get really skeevy, in which there is some microtransactions in the Squadron 42 single player game. So we'll see. But at least, hey, you know what? You have Gary Oldman and Mark Hamill and other real actors doing work on it. And Gary Oldman, of course, is overacting in it, which is glorious. I don't know if I want to play this multiplayer because I'm too afraid of griefing, and Sea of Thieves is just Grief City. Oh, by the way, just as we kind of figured out, people are really trashing Skull and Bones, just absolutely eviscerating it now that it's out.
Yeah. All that work and all those years. It's a quadruple A game, y'all.
Paying $100 for a piece of crap like that.
That is a true shame for everybody involved, for people that have to play it, for people that bought it, for people that developed it.
And people just want a pirate ship version of Guns of Icarus, damn it. Just do that.
The most important thing that Skull and Bones did, arguably, is convince people that they should go back and play Assassin's Creed Black Flag.
That's true.
Because sales of that game skyrocketed around the release of Skull and Bones. Because people want to see what the good one is like.
There's another pirate game that just came out as well. It's interesting. I think it's the Pirate Queen. I don't know if it's come out yet or not. But there is now a trend of people making pirate games.
Yeah. Yeah, like I've seen a couple in indie level, like not large scale, but like indie level pirate games start popping up on Steam recently. And they don't look half bad. Like I saw one on PC Gamer the other day. They were talking about one that actually seems like it could be like what people were looking for when they went to Skull and Bones.
And go ahead.
It's called Blackwake.
Yeah. I wonder why Microsoft decided to make Sea of Thieves multi-platform.
Yeah.
Now we're seeing the reasons behind Microsoft's actions. Like, why are they making Grounded multiple? Oh, small end. Why are they making Sea of Thieves? Oh, it's a live service game. And also, oh, there's another pirate game coming out. And also, I think they also made it multi-platform because of Skull and Bones too. I'm willing to bet you anything, people are going to be so annoyed with Skull and Bones. They're going to say, well, let me check out Sea of Thieves. Oh, wait, this is pretty good. I mean, the wave physics alone. Granted, the multiplayer is predatory, but, you know, that's what some people actually like. Predatory multiplayer. Oh, right, and there's also Tortuga, A Pirate's Tale. That's coming out from Calypso. Have you heard of Tortuga, A Pirate's Tale?
Yeah. So maybe there is a little bit of something good that comes out of Skull and Bones, and that's like the cyberpunk effect, right? Where it has enough of the conversation that a whole bunch of other developers are going ahead and trying for that.
Yeah, I just hope that the success of Baldur's Gate 3 makes people appreciate Pathfinder more. Pathfinder is the best D&D game that doesn't actually have a D&D license.
Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous was
Pillars of Eternity was good.
Well, that's not D&D though. That I mean, Pathfinder is literally D&D, just without the license on it. Because Pathfinder, I think, had this legal thing, and they won the right to publish their game, and it's sort of like a fan version of D&D, which actually holds like to the second edition, stuff like that. Now, yeah, Pillars of Eternity is great, but it's not D&D.
I mean, it does operate on, like, different rules and such, so I understand that much.
But I think it still has the spirit of what D&D is, to me, anyways.
Yeah.
But Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous was easily my favorite RPG of the year it came out. Like, that was done by, I think, Owlbear Games. And I would argue that they deserve as much praise as Larian for how they do their games, because they make a very, very, very good immersive isometric RPG.
Yeah, Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous came out in 2021.
Mm-hmm. I remember just like that was probably what got me. That was probably what moved me more towards Larian's Divinity series, because I played the heck out of Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous, and then I was like, man, I want to play more games like this, and then I started looking at what Larian was doing and saw that their stuff was really good.
Yeah. The only one negative review of Pathfinder Wrath of the Righteous that I found is that, well, this person says, you'll fight, you'll triumph, and you will save scum.
Yeah, it was pretty. It's a pretty hard game.
Yeah, a lot of people say you better mod this thing, mod it to hell. But you know what? Actually, you can get the console version for like $13 now for the game.
Mm-hmm. So,
getting back to Seattle, it's just depressing when you hear news of toxic stuff. I mean, Riot Games, I knew, is always going to be toxic. But, you know, Chris Roberts, I've never heard a bad word said about him, at least in terms of personality. Because you have to understand, for those who know, Cloud Imperium Games is run by Chris Roberts, who basically almost invented the space combat open world simulation. You know, the Wing Commander games, the Freelancer games, that sort of stuff. That's him. He's the one who's behind those.
Yeah. And I mean, it really does suck because, like.
Also, he was the one who was the first person bringing major actors into his games. You know, major, major actors.
Yeah.
Like when Mark Hamill appeared in Wing Commander, people were saying, oh, what?
Yeah.
I remember playing that game with him in there. Very good, very memorable.
Yeah, and then Tim Curry appeared in Command & Conquer, and it was all over.
Hey, before that happened, though, we got Bruce Campbell in Tachyon, and that was pretty good.
Mm. Bruce is always good.
Yeah, but he's not Mark Hamill. He doesn't have quite the even at the time, he wasn't Mark Hamill, right?
Sure, but
he was a B-movie actor.
He was fun in Tachyon, though. I liked that game.
There's a reason why Bruce is memorable as the Evil Dead thing, and with the chainsaw on his hand, and
he's unapologetically a B movie actor. He knows what he is. He's basically the male version of a scream queen. You know, I don't know. All this is starting to make me think. You know, I'd really like to see a Elite Dangerous 2, and hope, you know, see what they can do now that all these games are coming out. See how they can up their game. You know. I mean, you may scoff at Star Citizen, but it started a whole new round of space sims.
You know? It did.
The one game that everybody should try. I mean, I don't like it because for me the ships are like tissue paper. Oh God! It begins with an E. It had a sequel, and now I can. It's you know the game I'm talking about, right?
I think I do.
Everspace.
That's what I was getting there. But yes, that's the one.
I mean, it's always worth a try because it's a lot deeper than, you know, than it looks. It just, you think it's just like a simple, it's not even a great space combat sim. You know, it doesn't do the same thing that, say, you know, Star Citizen does, or even Star Wars Squadrons does. No. What it does is it takes a very simplified space combat sim and just makes it really deep, because then you have to start getting into, you know, exploring the universe and having all this stuff, you know. There's no multiplayer, but that's fine. There was the other game that came out which had sort of like a trucker space sim, you know. It was a space combat sim. It has sort of a trucker feel. I'm trying to remember the name of that game now.
I know what you're talking about, but I don't remember the name of it.
It had a really odd name to it, and it was a sequel that I played. It wasn't the original.
Yeah, I don't know. I know it exists, and I've heard of it, but I can't remember what name it is.
It was on Game Pass briefly.
I think one of the weirdest and funnest ones for me to come out of that period, as far as like the space sim stuff went, somebody actually went and made like a spaceship MOBA, like a League of Legends type game, where you would take a team of five ships against five other ships, and you would try to either destroy that, like you would go through the section of space that you're in and try to capture mining facilities for resources, and move towards your enemy's base and try to blow up their base.
Okay, I remember now. Rebel Galaxy Outlaw is the last one.
I do remember Rebel Galaxy. Yes,
that was Rebel Galaxy Outlaw.
But I remember Fractured Space, like there were so many different kinds of ships that you could use. And one of the ones that I would use was it could like teleport short distances. And if you teleported in directly into an enemy ship, like when you reappeared, it would like do ridiculous damage to them because you basically distorted space inside of their ship. It was just I kind of love that era. Yeah.
There's another game that came out to really mediocre reviews, and it was part of a series, X4 Foundations. And now people have sort of a soft spot for it. You know the X games, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So X4 Foundations is the last one that came out.
I played some of X2, I think. I thought it was cool. I thought it was interesting. But I also thought, like, the time that you would spend in there, it took a long time to get anywhere, and there was really not a lot of fast travel.
Hey, welcome to Elite Dangerous. That's why I want Elite Dangerous, too. I want them to up their game. They have so much. They just need now to be able to land on planets and do stuff on the surface of planets, you know? And the one thing that I want from Starfield and Star Citizen and every single space game is compatibility with my Oculus Quest, because that is the one way you'll get me to play your game forever, is have a space simulator in which you have VR.
Yeah, and Elite Dangerous, like, a lot of people said good things about Elite Dangerous VR. Didn't you? Weren't you one of the ones that tried it?
Yeah, and then it just got like Elite Dangerous. If you're
obviously
not doing,
obviously it just, killed VR, didn't it? Like they.
No, it didn't include it. They didn't include it. That's all.
Yeah.
The problem with Elite Dangerous, even when playing with VR, is that there's so much nothing in the game. There's too much nothing in the game. I know that's one of the highlights, but I'm not into space. I'm not into space combat. Here's the thing, though. Considering what happened to Fallout and considering what happened to Elder Scrolls, I have a feeling that VR will come to Starfield. It's just Bethesda's way. They'll release, here's an experimental VR version of our game. Come and try it. And it'll be buggy as hell, but people will still enjoy it.
Yeah.
I have to try the VR version of Elder Scrolls at some point. Look for our show notes at gamingpodcast.net, along with industry news and our gaming history articles. If you enjoy your feedback, leave us a comment on our blog at gamingpodcast.net. Also, hit us up at facebook.com/gamingpodcast. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us iTunes comments. You can find me on Twitter at Jonah Falcon.
You can find me at Johnny Chugs.
You can find me at Charter Morph.
And one of the funny things is that Podbean has been automatically uploading our episodes to YouTube. So hope if you're listening to us on YouTube, what is it? Like and subscribe and hit that
notification bell.
Yeah, no, hit the notification bell. Yeah, so yeah, we've been on YouTube for a while now because it just automatically uploads our episodes to YouTube. So yeah, just subscribe, hit the notification bell, like our video, but get us into the algorithm. Anyways, we will see you next week.
Happy gaming, everyone.
Have fun, be cool, play games, y'all.